The Spectator magazine combines incisive political commentary with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Stock up on your summer reading with a 12-week subscription, in print and online for just £12. Plus, we'll send you a copy of Spectator columnist Lionel Shriver's new book, The Motion of the Body Through Space, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/Lionel.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Fraser Nelson and James Forsyth. Today we have a new release of data from the ONS, which estimates that new infections of coronavirus are running at around 5,600 a day. That is down from 7,700 last week. So, James, what does this new data tells us? That coronavirus is gradually on the way out?
So it tells us the number of infections is still dropping, but it's not dropping as dramatically as I think many in the government hoped it would. There are people in government who privately think that the whole test, track and trace idea would work most effectively if you could get infections down to kind of 4,000 a day or less.
Fraser, what do you make of today's data? It does show there has been a big drop in cases, but as James says, if you think about how test and trace is most effective, it still is outside what many ministers are comfortable with.
Yes, of course, the problem with track and trace is that if 4 out of 5 people are asymptomatic, as a previous ONS study said, then how are you supposed to alert the authorities if you've got the virus? I mean, if we're told that there are 5,600 a day, on the last evidence, barely 4,500 of them won't even know that they have got it. It will come as a surprise to them to be diagnosed. And the other problem, of course, is now there are so few COVID cases in Britain that the people making our vaccines are having to go off to Brazil to try to find people with the virus to test it, because it is pretty rare. You've got a 1 in 1,000 chance of finding somebody in Britain with COVID. In London, it is far lower. I think there are only 20 cases a day in London. For the last 2 weeks, there have never been more than 40 cases a day in a city of 9 million. So I think this shows just how rare the virus is now, and how low your chances of catching it are. This ought to embolden ministers if you're thinking of opening up the society. We've still yet to see a resurgence of the virus in countries which have opened up. It adds to our understanding of where we are now, because when we locked down, we had absolutely no idea how many people had the virus, how fast it was growing. And that leads me on to something else, which I've written about in my Telegraph column today, and I'm going to write about on the website. A Bristol University study has found out that the virus actually peaked before lockdown, 5 or 6 days before, and was in fast decline by the time we locked down. This challenges the notion that it was lockdown, and only lockdown, which could have moderated the virus. And it underlines the theory that voluntary social distancing, washing of hands, other measures could have been enough to put the virus on the back foot. So we're still seeing more pictures of where we are now, where we were at the end of March, not just in Britain, but all over the world. And it all does point to a problem which is now manageable.
James, looking at today's data, what does this mean for the government's current outlook on lockdown? Ultimately, we know that when it comes to the various metrics they have come up with, there are numbers, what they view as the most important. We did have the different stages, you know, moving from 4 to 3. We haven't managed to move to 3 yet, but ministers tell us that it doesn't actually matter too much in terms of the easing of lockdown. So is the drop in cases going to boost the sense that we can move quickly, or will it not have an impact? Will it do the opposite?
This new ONS data is not a significant, it's not a big enough drop to decisively shift the debate in favour of further easing. I think you actually heard at Boris Johnson's press conference on Wednesday, I thought you could hear both Chris Whitty and Patrick Vallance really pushing for caution. It's quite clear that, and we know that Chris Whitty and the other chief medical officers of the other parts of the UK all kind of push to keep the threat level, if you will, at level 4 rather than going down to level 3. And I don't think this data will change their minds.
Fraser, key to easing out of lockdown, at least the way the government tells it, is test and trace. But we find out today that the idea of having an app involved in this is not going to be fully functioning for quite some time. What's going on?
What's going on is that the app doesn't really work, and it's not going to work properly for months. by the time it does work properly, it might or might not be useful for a second wave if a second wave emerges. It does seem to me as if the government is lagging the virus by several weeks, sometimes months, in its response. But by the time October comes, it's far from clear that there's going to be a virus to still deploy against it. So I think what we're seeing now is that the government is just simply too late to catch it this time around. If there is going to be a resurgence, the government may or may not have the tools to handle it then. But again, it's another example of the government over-promising and under-delivering. We were promised a world-class track-and-trace system, and in a conference call yesterday, the guy in charge of that system said that the world-class element is going to be months away, by which stage it will be too late. I'm afraid to say that it is increasingly difficult to look at the government's response to the COVID crisis and find anything really to boast about. I think there is a reason that the Brits are one of the countries least impressed with their government's response to COVID. We've ended up with more deaths than the most other countries per capita. We've ended up with more deficit and more economic damage than almost anybody else in Europe. It's difficult to see what Britain has got to point to. And I've actually, yesterday, I took several calls from politicians, Tory politicians, who's saying their increasing amount of despair about the government's handling about this. The fact that we're not taking the threat level down despite infections being so low as to be negligible in the city. To Tory MPs, this just demonstrates a complete collapse of confidence in the government's part. They're not quite sure who's in charge. They're not quite sure if cabinet is even functioning. And I'm beginning to become increasingly alarmed about whether this government is operating in any real sense at all. It certainly does seem to be as if we're jumping from one misfortune to another, the failure of the track and trace app being simply the latest in a series of misfortunes.
James, Boris Johnson said this week that he was very proud of his government's efforts in the handling of coronavirus. Do you think that was a misjudgment, to use that type of language, given everything Fraser's just cited?
I think there is an issue. I mean, not to be overly self-referential, but I think there is an issue, as I said in the poll call this week. In private, senior figures in government admit that they've got some things wrong, that the things that they are clearly doing differently now from the beginning of a crisis are an admission that the initial phase was a mistake. I think Boris Johnson would do well to be kind of clearer with people about what specific mistakes he thinks the government has made and how they are trying to fix it. Trying to maintain that he's proud of a government's response when the ways in which things are being reorganised clearly shows that the government recognised that there were problems. It is creating a disconnect. I think if you're going to maintain public confidence, he would be well advised to talk frankly about how certain things didn't work, how this country was ill-prepared for dealing with a coronavirus rather than a flu pandemic. I think that would actually encourage more public confidence. I mean, the public are perfectly prepared for a grown-up discourse about how difficult it is to deal with a virus about which we still know so little. And I think just trying to maintain that it's all right, I think that, you know, the focus groups are encouraging him to believe that, you know, it is effective to say, well, in answer to Keir Starmer's questions, you know, look, the country wants you to be constructive. That might be right about what the current mood is. That mood is not going to last forever. And I think that Boris Johnson would be well to get ahead of it and start saying, look, you know, these are the things we got wrong and this is how we set about fixing them.
But I'm not entirely sure they even know what they got wrong. I mean, for example, one of the popular theories at the moment is that they abandoned track and trace at too early a stage. That assumes that it's possible to track and trace a virus spread by people who show no symptoms. There are a lot of scientists and public health officials who think that track and trace might work for something like Ebola. If you've got that, you absolutely know that you've got it. But if COVID can be so mild as to leave most people unaware that they've got it, will track and trace necessarily work then? I mean, at the time, right early on, the role of asymptomatic spreaders was far less understood than it is now. So the funny thing about this is that the science is still all over the place, really. There are all kinds of theories. There is a theory that effectively we could have hit herd immunity already because they are such things as this immunological dark matter out there, dark, which will stop the growth because a lot of us might be resistant to it already. And then you've got at the other extreme Imperial College saying that 80% of the population would likely to get it unless you lock down. We still don't know if lockdown was an effective tool or not. We still don't know how effective social distancing was. And it's strange that right now, after weeks of this, the government might want to say, OK, here is what we got wrong. But I'm not even sure it's at that stage yet. It's pretty clear to everybody that a whole bunch of things went wrong in Britain. But, I mean, I don't know, James, what do you think? If you wanted to be Boris Johnson and be optimistic, what would you point to that they have actually got right since this crisis broke?
I think in terms of what they've got right, I think you can say that the creation of the extra NHS capacity, so you didn't have hospital systems we know of. Now, I think there has to be a caveat added to that, which is, did the desire to free up hospital beds unintentionally lead to the virus being pushed into care homes? I mean, that's the caveat you have to add that question. I think that you can say, I think at the beginning of this crisis, few would have thought that the government would be, few would have thought two things, actually. One, that universal credit, which has been plagued by its own IT troubles, would have stood up to the huge increase in the number of claimants. And then I think people would have been sceptical, again, because of government IT failures in the past, of the government's ability to create the ability to pay workers' wages, to offer the self-employed money. I mean, people would have thought there'd be far more cases of companies not getting that cash or individuals not getting that cash. I think those two kind of, you know, the furlough scheme, the self-employed stuff, the universal credit, all those bits have functioned relatively effectively.
The economic side
I also think if you'd increased testing earlier, one of the things that I think that Matt Ridley keeps saying, and I think there's a lot of truth to this, is this seems to be particularly dangerous in hospitals and care homes. If you had had more testing from earlier on, you could have been testing all NHS staff, and that could have helped with infection control in hospitals. You could have been testing all patients before they were discharged to care homes, which again would have helped with infection control. So I think those are the kind of things that Boris Johnson could point to and say they got wrong. I also think there is a danger that you made an error early on in the crisis and then you try and fix it at the wrong moment, which is what I think is going on with the quarantine policy. With the benefit of hindsight, it's clear that there should have been a quarantine policy before the February half term. It looks like lots of the UK's cases were basically brought back from people returning from that half term from Italy and Spain. But I think that a quarantine policy now risks causing a major retardation to the economic recovery.
And finally, Fraser, on the issue of the quarantine policy, we've been documenting this week, both on this podcast and on Coffee House, how badly it is going down with the Conservative Party. Scientists also don't seem particularly fond of the logic or perhaps lack of logic behind it. But there is a sense that in terms of public opinion, that's where there is the most favourable reception. Do you think this quarantine policy is going to last the month? I mean, the government would have to potentially win a vote to continue it in several weeks' time, which could be tricky.
That's right. And I was speaking to an MP yesterday who was saying, look, they're not going to win the vote here. They're not going to get this quarantine policy past Parliament. When Priti Patel was discussing it in Parliament on Wednesday, I was told by one MP who was there, it was the first time in his quite long parliamentary career that he's ever witnessed not a single Tory MP being behind the policy of a Tory government. The government has struggled to justify this in any kind of scientific format. It would do huge damage to prospects of an economic revival. And I think we're going to start to see now an increasing rebellious mood against Tory MPs who have basically lost faith in the government's ability to handle the crisis and will not let it pass measures that it wants to pass. I've always thought, ever since that we failed to stem the number of deaths, that the government would be just so shocked by its failure here with 50,000 people dying that we would be fated to simply ride right behind all of the other countries coming out of lockdown, kind of copying what they're doing and going at the end. And when the government wants to stand out, like keep a 14-day quarantine policy, I think the backbenchers will be quite inclined to shoot it down. So right now, I think it's touch and go whether this would pass Parliament, and I certainly don't think it would last the month, because I think the medical debate is evolving very quickly. I mean, we started this podcast talking about infections being down at 5,600 a day. This mirrors what we're seeing in the rest of Europe. So if the epidemic is in its dying stages, then I think the focus will start to turn to economic revival sooner rather than later.
Thank you, Fraser. Thank you, James. And thank you for listening. And while I have you here, if you would like to hear more about views on the lockdown, do check out the latest Women with Balls episode where I interview Professor Sunitra Gupta. She's a professor of epidemiology at Oxford, and we discuss both her career and her own studies on terms of the level of infection and what this means going forward.
The Spectator magazine combines incisive political commentary with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Stock up on your summer reading with a 12-week subscription, in print and online, for just £12. Plus, we'll send you a copy of Spectator columnist Lionel Shriver's new book, The Motion of the Body Through Space, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/Lionel.